My name is Lee Cazell, and I'm the Federalist Society's Vice President for our Lawyers Chapters. On behalf of our chapter leadership in Florida and our national staff, I'd like to thank you all for joining us this weekend for our 7th Annual Florida Chapters Conference. And I'd like to offer a special welcome to all who are watching this on live stream from across Florida and the United States. It goes without saying that this has been an interesting year. I'm extraordinarily grateful for the dedication of our volunteers, our speakers, and our staff for all of their hard work to organize this conference. It's one of our signature events. It's not the conference we envisioned, but just to have the opportunity to engage in some fellowship and see so many dear friends is greatly appreciated. I also want to thank all of you who are attending this year. We have missed seeing you at Federalist Society events around the country and in Florida. A word about the Federalist Society. Our mission is to sponsor fair, serious, and thoughtful debate and discussion about the need to enhance individual freedom and what the proper role of the courts and judges is in saying what the law is and not what it should be. The Federalist Society is primarily about ideas. We do not take positions, endorse candidates, issue policy statements, or file amicus briefs or litigate. And we never have, and we never will. We respect the diversity of views our members hold on all issues concerning public policy. Florida Federalist Society, in particular, is reflective of the diversity of these views. We have over a dozen lawyers' chapters covering virtually the entire state, and we're always looking to expand. All of our chapter presidents, I believe, are here this weekend, and they look forward to working with our members to advance the Federalist Society's mission. Don't be shy about contacting them or contacting somebody in the national office if you'd like to get more involved in a chapter. Just a couple of housekeeping items before we turn things over to our first panel. As you can tell, mask wearing is being strictly enforced, as is social distancing. We ask that you adhere to these policies to ensure the safety of our guests. When we break for lunch, we will also ask for social distancing as well, and the staff here at the hotel will help us with service. With that, I'm going to turn things over to James Elfmeyer, Acting General Counsel to Governor DeSantis. He will be moderating our opening panel on what has been the defining event of the past year, COVID and the separation of powers. James is a Gator, a graduate of the University of Florida for undergrad and grad school, and he's also an alum of Georgetown Law. Before making his way back home to Florida, he worked in D.C. at Jones Day and for the Department of Commerce. James, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Lisa. We've got a great panel up here. I've always envied the moderator at FedSoc Talks because it just seems like a great job. You get to ask tough questions and you don't have to have any of the answers. So I'm looking forward to my first foray here. We'll introduce the panel here. We've got Joe Jayco, who was the last general counsel to the governor and spearheaded the emergency order response to COVID-19. He's now in private practice at Gunster. We've got Secretary Simone Marstiller from the Department of Juvenile Justice, Chad Mizell, the former acting general counsel for the Department of Homeland Security, and Chad previously served as a senior attorney at the Department of Justice and White House counsel. We have Honorable Paul Renner here, a member and speaker designate of the Florida House of Representatives. So just to kick us off, I'm going to turn it over to each of you, and I'll start on this side here with you, Representative Renner, just to give us a little bit of an introduction for a couple minutes. And I think it'd be neat to hear kind of what was the biggest thing you were working on or involved in before we hit March 1 of last year? And then obviously, how has life changed and what has your role been in this effort to combat COVID-19?
Thank you, James, and it's really great to be with you. It's hard to think back to what it was before because so much has changed. And it seems to me that there's a bit of irony that we're having a very, very important conversation about separation of powers and what, in my perspective, has been executive overreach, constitutional overreach around the country. Ironic in the sense that we're blessed with a governor that we have here in Florida who does consult with our legislature, and who I think most people in this room would agree has gotten it right, who's really been not only someone who is familiar with the Federalist Papers, but actually has read them and is focused on the constitutional separation of powers. It is, I think, the beauty of our system. While the Bill of Rights and other aspects of our Constitution perhaps get more play, I think really the genius of our Constitution are the checks and balances present in the separation of powers. Both horizontal, we have the executive, legislative, and judicial, but also vertically, federal, state, and local. And so preserving those really is about preserving individual liberty. And so before I pass the microphone, just to frame up the conversation a little bit, it's really about two principles. One is that one branch may not encroach on the powers, the constitutional powers of another branch. And secondly, is that one branch, may not delegate its assigned constitutional powers to another. The first really being about what I think we've seen across the country, which in this case is examples of the executive rightly addressing and rightly being aggressive about addressing a very serious virus, but going beyond the what is really necessary to do so and stepping into either the legislative or judicial realm. And secondly is really an abdication on the part of the legislatures around the country to have delegated too much power in the first place. And looking critically as we get through this and the lessons learned, it's our role as a legislature to go back with the experience and with time and judgment to look at what needs to be changed post-COVID and even now during COVID to make sure that we are respecting our separation of powers. So I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you. Secretary?
Well, thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. I'm really glad to be here, particularly because this is my first time on this side of the stage. Normally, I would have been out there with you all, and I'm really honored to be here to talk to you all a little bit today about what it has been like from an agency's perspective and an agency head's perspective dealing with COVID. As you all, I'm sure, can imagine, DJJ is stressful as it is, although I do tend to joke, there's never a dull day at DJJ, and that's true. And that certainly has been the case during COVID. But, you know, we have all been acutely aware of our responsibility at this agency, not only because we deal with lives, but we deal with children's lives, and we deal with other people's children's lives. So the gravity of that has not escaped my staff, as you can imagine. Now, we're all going to talk a bit more about the extent of the governor's authority in emergency situations and how that trickled down to the agencies. And I'm going to read a letter to you all just sort of to kick off my part. But a lot of really most of what we dealt with at DJJ was more operational, as you can imagine. So it was immediately figuring out how to put together a pandemic plan that the agency had never had before. You all may or may not realize that the Department of Juvenile Justice operates juvenile justice from end to end. So unlike the adult system where sheriffs operate the jails and Secretary Inch operates the prisons, I operate both sets of that in juvenile world. And so on the front end, we had to do a lot of work with our other branch partners, the courts in particular, to make sure that we were keeping kids, we were not bringing in too many kids to detention unless it was absolutely necessary. And then on the other end of that, the residential commitment side, which is post-adjudication, keeping that flow kind of going, but at the same time, you know, dealing with what we were dealing with health-wise in those facilities. The other confounding thing for us was keeping, you know, abreast of the ever-changing CDC guidelines, because those really did drive a lot of how we operated inside our facilities, keeping our designated health authorities online. You all, or in line, you all think that it's difficult to get lawyers to agree to something? Try getting doctors to agree to something. It was a challenge, but you know, we've done a great job, and you know, our kids. Thank goodness, actually, I'm dealing with a population of kids because they have strong immune systems and have weathered the COVID storm very, very well. But I'm going to tee up and give you all a teaser of some of our authority, you know, challenges that we dealt with as well as the governor. So this was actually a letter, and Joe, you will probably remember this because I'm sure you had to approve my response to it. This letter came from a state attorney. And it read, and it was to the governor, and she said, like so many other agencies, COVID-19 has significantly impacted SA09 and the way we function, yet we've been working diligently to protect our staff and our community while adapting to both the Florida Supreme Court orders and our local administrative orders. There is, however, a significant threat related to juvenile delinquency that needs your immediate attention. I'm extremely concerned about the safety of not just my community, but that of all Floridians. I remain rooted in my efforts to address ills in our criminal justice system while never losing sight of public safety. And the letter goes on to talk about the fact that at that point, the Florida Supreme Court had suspended, among other things, juvenile adjudications, but would allow them to occur by video if all parties agreed. So anyway, this letter explains, you know, oh, that's a problem because juvenile delinquency scores for secure detention are required to be brought to trial within 21 days, but this is not happening, and so these, you know, in this person's opinion, very dangerous youth are out there presenting a danger to public safety. And so the danger she outlines, quote, could be eliminated by an executive order tolling Florida Statute 985.262A, which is the 21-day deadline, specifically for violent crimes, including firearms and all first-degree felonies. I have spoken to Senator Bracey regarding the possibility of legislative action, but the urgency of this matter is best remedied through executive action. So understand what the state attorney was asking the governor to do. She was asking the governor to issue an executive order to keep a particular class of juvenile in detention longer than the statutory 21-day deadline. I will leave it there. I hope you look forward to my response to this letter.
Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, thanks, James. I just wanted to start by describing a little bit of the governor's Office of General Counsel. And I'll first just say we have incredibly talented lawyers there. So it was just a pleasure for me to be able to work with those lawyers as I was in that office for the past 2 years. When I describe the office, I usually describe it in three buckets. First is we advise the governor. And as you saw last night, he's a very robust client. So that was always fantastic. We handle judicial appointments. And many of you in the audience know the fence hypo very well, which was a pleasure to work through with you. And then we did everything else legal. So for COVID, that really involved three things in particular. We developed and drafted the governor's executive orders. I was looking back at it this morning. We had over 50 executive orders. And we offered the governor same-day service for those, and he took us up on it. So that was kind of an all-hands-on-deck endeavor whenever we were drafting an order. It could be mortgage foreclosure or eviction forestalling. It could be medical procedures, availability. I mean, you guys are familiar with them, but it was a full deck. The second thing we did is we reviewed all of the agency legal actions. And as Secretary Marstaller was saying, those came up to our office in these red folders. And as I say that, Colleen Ernst is probably shuddering because she had the healthcare portfolio, and there were hundreds of these red folders that would come up. So that was a constant daily review in our office. Third thing is we litigated defending the governor's actions both in federal and state court. Probably the most unique one for this panel was a challenge we got from the Panhandle, a lawyer named Ann Ufelder, who wanted the governor to use his executive authority to close beaches. And so he sued, basically trying to get the judge to use the governor's authority to close beaches. He did not prevail, even though he dressed up in a Grim Reaper outfit and would go out to the beach in this black hood and sickle and scare little kids. So he got a bit of PR out of that. I think he's facing sanctions now. But that was certainly an interesting case on separation of powers, and appropriately the courts stayed out of it. Practically, when we were looking at the governor's authority from the start, we were very concerned about the extent of his executive power. We first utilized the authority that the Surgeon General has in Statute 381 to issue a public health emergency, which allows for the quarantining of people. Then we issued a state of emergency that under Statute 252 gives the governor broad authority. The two provisions we particularly relied on were his ability to suspend the operation of a regulatory statute, and secondly, to take measures to control civilians. And so as we, you know, looked at every executive order, we would reevaluate our authority under those provisions. And in our office, we tried to really scrutinize and critique it. What does the text say? Does the text give us this authority in the context of this emergency? And we really made an effort in every executive order to be able to pin that executive order on something that we could find in the text, not just to kind of generally cite, you know, 252, but to really think through the specific subsection and authority we're relying on. The flip side of that is, okay, fine, you know, so we do our textual analysis, the interpretation, we find the authority, but what about people's liberties? What about their rights? You know, are we infringing on those? And it was a constant concern. And I'll tell you, more than once the governor said to me, he said, Joe, he said, look, if you have to go defend this in court and you realize that we've gone too far, he's like, let the judge do it. You know, let the judge say so. He said, you know, we're doing our best here, but we don't know the outer limits of this. And he was very concerned and cognizant about that. I can tell you a little more about that. I think we're going to talk some about the stay-at-home order in a minute. The last thing I'll just mention is in relation to the separation of powers, this dynamic we had between the state and localities, and I'm sure Chad will talk about a little bit from the federal government in the states, was something that was an additional dynamic that we grappled with. You know, we certainly wanted locals to be able to care for their own citizens, but we also had to think about our ability to preempt to utilize the police powers that reside in the state to really make the best call. And so that was another dynamic that I'll get into a little bit later. And you know, it was one that was at times very collaborative, and at other times, I mean, towards the end of it, the governor issued an executive order essentially eviscerating any local fines or imprisonment that they applied for people not wearing masks, or for business owners not, you know, following some particular, you know, COVID edict. And we just thought, look, that's just the abuse of power. Anyway, why don't I stop right there, and we'll answer some questions.
Sure. Chad?
Well, first off, let me say thank you very much. Honored to be here. As Joe hinted at, I kind of come at this from a slightly different perspective, both the federal perspective, having served as the acting general counsel at the Department of Homeland Security, which includes FEMA, which played a major role in helping respond to the COVID-19 crisis. You know, and now is my role as a lawyer in private practice at Jones Day, advising clients and representing clients who are faced with these crippling restrictions. The one thing that I've seen, and the one thing that I think that as we look back on this time in history, we are all going to realize, is that in these last 10 months, the COVID restrictions, I believe, have been one of the greatest infringements on individual liberties, perhaps, that we've seen since the founding of our nation. We've had previously unthinkable restrictions on our right to worship, our right to assemble, our right to bear arms. States are shutting down gun shops, manufacturing, gun ranges. Our right to personal property. We're being told who we're allowed to have into our home for Thanksgiving dinner in certain states, how many people you can have at Thanksgiving dinner, how you can use your business, how you can use your property. The right to travel between states was restricted. The right to a speedy trial has fallen apart in many, many federal jurisdictions. The right to a jury trial has essentially fallen apart in many jurisdictions. And in some states, there's no end in sight. And I think at this moment in time, we have the benefit of not just looking hindsight 2020, but I think we still have an opportunity to do something about this and change something because we're still in the middle of this crisis for certain states. Thankfully, not Florida, but for some others. So I think there's some important questions we need to be asking. The first one, since we are talking about separation of powers, is did our framers plan for this type of overreach in the Constitution? After looking at this question, I think the answer is not exactly. They certainly took steps to prevent some of the abuses that we saw in the Articles of Confederation. They took steps to prevent the states from being able to cripple the federal government. Madison talks about this in Federalist 45, where he talks about the powers of the federal government and the states. Here's what he says about state powers, that they extend to all of the objects which, in the ordinary course of affairs, concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. The founders envisioned that the states would have the authority to, in the general police powers, to govern the lives of their individuals. And as far as I read the Constitution, I don't see a strong structural protection that is protecting individuals against state overreach. Well, I think that leads to a second question. Does that mean we're powerless? Well, absolutely not. First off, after the passage of the 14th Amendment, we have the Bill of Rights of being applied to the states. I think that's a tremendous protection that has been utilized all across the country to fight back against certain restrictions, particular restrictions on religious liberty. We have state separation of powers, both state constitutions, state laws. I have a couple examples, which I think we're going to get to later in the panel. But the last thing, and I think the most important thing that we can do, and this will sort of close my opening, is that I think it's incumbent upon all of us to recognize these abuses, to call them out where we see them, and to fight for our individual liberties. Oftentimes, that is going to mean through filing lawsuits. We have seen aggressive action from a number of interested parties and stakeholders all across the country suing to reopen, churches suing to reopen, businesses suing to reopen, people suing to have their kids have the right to go back to school. I think that is an important step and something that is going to be crucial to these next 4, 6, 8 months as we continue the fight against, again, what I believe is some of the greatest restrictions on individual liberty that we have probably seen since the founding of our country.
Thanks, Chad. Joe, we'll start off with you. Here in Florida, we did have a stay-at-home order. Thankfully, ours was only in place for about 5, maybe 6 weeks. You talked a little bit about the authorities that you would look to and pull from when drafting some of these orders. What authority specifically did you pull from for the stay-at-home order? And just tell us a little bit about, you know, how that developed and how it might have been different from what was present in other states.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way the stay-at-home order came about is the governor had been traveling throughout March and really kind of trying to assess on the ground what was going on with COVID, and was continually getting requests from local officials to do more, right? Things that we thought that they would have in their own authorities, but you know, sometimes whether it was jurisdictional issues between a city and a county, or whether it was concerned about people traveling from one county to another, there was a real call for the state to take action. I mean, even to the point that we used the governor's authority to close the beaches in Broward because, for whatever reason, they couldn't get that done. They came and requested that of us. So that was really the impetus behind the stay-at-home order, was the local requests. And as a result, the governor said, okay, you know, we'll do this over a short-term period. We did it for only the month of April. And when we began to look at what that should be like, well, one, we not only offered same-day service, we offered all-night service in the drafting of that executive order. But we looked at EOs from around the country, certainly Texas, Tennessee were big models, Ohio we looked at, California we even looked at, trying to get a sense of how states are doing this. The way it broke down, and I'll tell you, we had some significant internal debate in our office, particularly kind of legal and policy over this, was to what extent should the state use its authority to shut down business? And I was, and you can see it in the final order, not a proponent of that. There is plenty of authority on the local level, whether it's their sanitation authority, their fire department authority, their building code authority, to handle how to deal with venues, buildings, business, right? I mean, and certainly the Department of Homeland Security had its essential services list, which was a template that everyone was following, right? So that was already going to be addressed. The real authority that the state had, other than some authority in the regulation of alcohol, so we could control bars and restaurants, and so we used that particular state authority in statute, was taking measures to control the conduct of civilians or the ingress and egress of people. And so our stay-at-home order was only addressed to individuals to say, stay home, right, unless you're going to these essential services. And that was a critical difference for us, because I'll give you an example. I live in Jacksonville, Florida, in an area called San Marco, and there's this great independent bookstore that I love going to. And, you know, the city obviously closed her down. And she ended up, though, figuring out how to move her audit inventory online and allow people then to access it and purchase books at a 50% discount, but they can't come pick them up until she's able to open her doors again, right? So she could continue to get revenue, right? She could continue to pay her employees. If we at the state level had shut down her business, she wouldn't have been able to do that. But just because the city shut her building, it allowed her to continue to operate, right? And that's the kind of entrepreneurism that we wanted to continue and that the governor was very proud of. And he's got a list of examples of that. I mean, even where my wife gets her hair done, they sold color out of the back door, right? You could do a drive-by and go pick up your product. It was awesome, right? And you just do it at home. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that we loved seeing. And so anyway, I think that really distinguished us from a lot of states. And I think you see that in the governor's attitude now, that he's motivated by that we've got that kind of spirit here to figure out how to make it work if you just give individuals the opportunity.
I know hindsight's 20/20, but looking back, would you have done anything differently?
You know, I will say two things. One, you know, there was that continual concern about individual rights. We tried to bake some of that into our executive order. I mean, the governor was unique in that stay-at-home order. He protected the ability to attend church, right? So we didn't want locals to shut that down, right? The ability to participate in recreational activities, even the ability, and like these are the words we use, to visit a loved one, right? I mean, these are things that go towards, you know, people's livelihood, right? And we wanted to protect that. I mean, for goodness sakes, we're in a democracy, and so we have to protect those. And if there was anything that, any mistake we had in this stay-at-home order, it was a little bit of a Frankenstein project. Again, I said it was all night because we took some language from different orders, and we had one mistake in there where we had the ability to preempt locals, but we added some language about only where they essentially restricted activities that were prohibited by the governor's order. Well, the governor didn't prohibit anything, so we dropped that language in a correction the next day. Well, the locals blew up. I mean, they thought that we were coming in with the cavalry to preempt them. And, you know, it was days of explanation that, no, you guys can control buildings. We are doing the stay-at-home on people, two different fields of regulation. But I will say, as a result of that, you know, we talked with different businesses, let's say, you know, Publix and other retailers, about locals coming in and trying to dictate how they, you know, set up their cash registers or set up their, you know, aisles. And what I think we should do, and I've mentioned this to the Florida Chamber of Commerce, is we need to think about what happens the next time we're in a pandemic. And there are certification organizations. I mean, there's ANSI, that's a national organization that, you know, if we could have retailers come up with a gold standard plan, get that approved. I mean, states have legislative authority that says, look, if you have this, again, let's say ANSI certification, then you're exempt from all of the local regulations the next time we're in a pandemic. We really need to think about a way to turn that back to business and let them figure out how to protect their own customers and employees. So that, I would say that would be the one takeaway.
Okay. Representative Renner, we're going to turn to you now. The governor's powers under 252 are quite broad, albeit not as broad as some other states. But if you haven't pulled it up, pull up 252.36, and you can see he's got the power to you know, regulate the movement, the ingress and egress of people, to regulate the sale of alcohol or firearms. And then there's this catch-all that says that the governor has the ability to suspend the provisions of any regulatory statute prescribing the procedures for conduct of state business or the orders or rules of any state agency if strict compliance with the provisions would in any way prevent, hinder, or delay necessary action in coping with the emergency. So I think there has been some misinformation out there that the governor can create new law. He clearly doesn't have the ability to do that here in Florida. He just has the ability to suspend regulatory burdens. The legislature clearly gave the governor all this power and statute, but do you feel like it's power that's encroaching upon the proper body to create law, which is the legislature?
Thank you, James. And I think in looking at that answer to that question, we have to think about not what has happened, but what could happen, and kind of put on our hats to say, if we were to try to achieve an outcome that perhaps no one in this room would want to achieve, could we do it under the existing statute? And reading a little bit farther down in 252.36, subparagraph 5 says, in addition to any other powers conferred upon the governor by law, she or he may, and two spring to mind. One is to suspend or limit the sale, dispensing, or transportation of, and I'm excerpting here, firearms. And then it exempts out, of course, taking or seizing firearms that are lawfully possessed. But if a governor came in and declared a crisis, an emergency of gun violence, could you immediately halt the sale of firearms, not taking away from those that already possessed it, but could you do that? Now, you might say, well, the Second Amendment would address that and could be subject to court challenge. And then going down a couple paragraphs in subparagraph J, it says, take effective measures for limiting or suspending, and it goes on to say, lighting devices and appliances, gas and water mains, electric power distribution, and all other utility services in the general public interest. Now, I read that, as most of you would, as I read it, thinking we're talking about hurricanes. You need to stop, you know, a substation so that the people from FPNL or the utility can come out and fix a down power line. They're not electrocuted. But what about if a governor were to come in and say, I find that climate change is a natural emergency under the definition of the statute, and I'm going to take measures to limit or suspend electric power distribution that comes from fossil fuels. And on it goes. And so I think you have to really stress test this. And I think the experience of COVID, while certainly important that the governor have very wide latitude to address it, and I want to be clear about that, is what happens when it is now kind of the test platform for other crises that are real or imagined to be implemented through a state's statute or some appeal to inherent authority. And we already see, this is not just paranoia, but I've heard some rumors in one of our counties about a local government prohibiting the introduction of any fossil fuels through their jurisdictional limits. And it happens to be an area that we rely on to receive our petroleum. And so this is not any more far-fetched. And so I think we do really have to kind of revisit not what has happened, but what could happen in light of a very hard reading of the statute if you were looking to get around it to justify an outcome that is desired in the name of some real or imagined crisis.
Now, Chapter 252 does have a provision where the legislature can come back at any time and, you know, without the governor's approval, vote by proclamation to end the state of emergency. Does that give you any comfort?
It does not. Actually, the way I read the statute, and that's in an earlier section, subparagraph 2, it does have that provision where we can come in. And what's interesting is it allows the governor to renew that executive order, and it does not put a hard stop. It allows the legislature, and says the legislature, by concurrent resolution, may terminate a state of emergency at any time, and so we would have to elect to do that. And notably, it's about the actual emergency. Well, I don't know any legislator, including this one, that would at this point or at any point to date want to go in and declare that there's not a COVID emergency. There absolutely is a COVID emergency. And so we're fully on board with that prospect. But I don't know that we couldn't improve upon this language as to any given executive order that is that falls under that emergency. And in the case of Michigan, there's a great case in certified question of the federal courts where the Supreme Court in Michigan declared unconstitutional the governor's exercise of her authority there. And there it was actually explicit where it gave her 28 days, and then the executive order was to terminate unless it was affirmatively approved by the legislature, which I like that language a bit better. And she went ahead and simply renewed it unilaterally without the involvement of the legislature. And they clearly said that that was unconstitutional. And we might get to talk later about the rest of that case because it dealt with a non-delegation doctrine as well. But I commend that case to you to look at. But it does give me some comfort, but I question whether paragraph 2 can be read in peri materia with subsection 5 when it says, in addition to any other powers conferred upon the governor by law, she or he may, and it has that laundry list. And James read A, which talks about suspending regulatory provisions, but then goes on and has this laundry list. And so, again, you know, it's as simple as this was written quite some time ago by a legislature that no longer exists, you know, beginning in 1974. And so it's incumbent on us to, in conjunction, and it is in full cooperation with this governor, to look at, you know, how do we strengthen this? How do we give better guidance to a Joe Jaco to come to make sure that there's no nothing equivocal, nothing ambiguous in the language, and nothing, more importantly, that if someone else comes in that has designs to evade the legislative power, that they can't do that without a real emergency existing or our ability to come in and say that's not what we want.
Now, the governor's authorities in 252 are also extended by delegation to agency heads. So, you know, Joe mentioned the 50 or more executive orders that the governor has signed related to COVID-19, but there was a stretch of time there where we were reviewing and cranking out hundreds upon hundreds of agency emergency rules and emergency orders, and that sounds very scary that you've got all these various agencies that are kind of deviating from standard law. But it also was extremely necessary to be able to do what needed to be done. Secretary, will you tell us a little bit about kind of what the mechanics of that looked like, you know, on a day-to-day basis? And do you think it is necessary for agency heads to have this delegated authority?
I absolutely think it's necessary for the agency heads to have this authority because we are responsible in our respective substantive areas for getting the things done and for doing the work for the people that we serve. And we understand, and thankfully we serve a governor who understands that his authority, while he may have the authority and power to do certain things, he is very conscious of making sure he doesn't overstep. You've heard Joe talk about the discussions that they had in issuing the executive orders that the governor has done. And so those of us who work for him understand that we should take our guidance from that, and we have only done what is necessary, but things have to be done. So for example, in my agency, I ended up only issuing one emergency order, which I renewed twice, and it had to do with suspending our rules requiring visitation for children in our detention centers and our residential commitment programs. I will tell you all that we thought long and hard before we did it. We had a lot of discussions internally and with the governor's office about the pros and cons of doing that. Because, you know, Secretary Inch at Corrections, he did the same thing, but he's dealing with adults, and we understand that there are differences, right, between clearly adults and kids. And we waited as long as we possibly could to suspend parental and family visitation to our facilities. And when we did so, we did it for as short a period of time as we possibly could, just to see how the public health emergency was progressing, to make sure that our kids were recovering from their infections, et cetera, et cetera. So I think I did it maybe 30 days at a time. But we know that children in these facilities need the contact of their parents. They need to be able to see mentors and things like that. So I was very careful about that. But that was the only, frankly, emergency order that I issued at DJJ. Everything else that we did, from requiring the kids to wear masks, and even that we had to talk a lot about because there were safety concerns, as you can imagine. But everything else that we did in dealing with COVID was operational and was within the authority that I already had as an agency head. And so that made it easier to get things done. Let's, you know, put it that way. And of course, it lessened the burden on the governor's office. We didn't have to issue any emergency rules, like, say, the Agency for Healthcare Administration, which did issue, and correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, I think that agency issued some emergency rules requiring individuals working inside ALFs and nursing homes to get tested every 2 weeks. We talked about the wisdom of doing that at DJJ, and we opted not to move forward with that. I think a lot of what we dealt with from a separation of powers, extent of authority perspective was, you know, coming from groups, advocacy groups who wanted certain things done. So it was either, I was either being asked to keep kids in detention or I was being asked to release kids from detention and residential commitment. It was, you know, there was a lot of that. And the letter that I read to you all earlier is a very, very good example of that. if the governor's authority only extended to suspending regulatory statutes, and if the agencies could only, you know, change their orders or suspend the operation of rules of that agency. I mean, that language is clear both in the statute and in the governor's executive order. It continues to confound me that we are asked to do things that we know, that I'm sure the advocates know that we cannot do. So I will circle back to my response to the letter from the state attorney, the then state attorney for the Ninth Judicial Circuit. And let me just back up. For those of you in the audience who know me, you know that when I saw the letter from the state attorney, I was geeked to answer to it, to give her an answer, because I thought, oh, this is going to be good. And so I did. I asked to issue the response on the governor's behalf. And so, among other things, I said, you know, your request to suspend the 21-day limit would abridge the constitutional due process rights of juveniles. Not only that, your request would create a new law by specifying classes of youth to whom such a suspension would apply, raising additional constitutional questions. Now, I mean, law students, I'm fairly certain, would know that by executive order, a governor cannot do what this state attorney was asking to do. But here's the best part, ladies and gentlemen. All of this had nothing really to do with the governor's authority to do anything. This only had to do with her needing to address a problem that pre-existed COVID. And I was kind enough to point that out in my response. And I said, I must also question the need for this extreme measure, as case processing times in Circuit 9 are not a new issue. Your request suggests that the Florida Supreme Court's order will cause an unprecedented number of dangerous youth to be released from detention because they can't be tried in time. Our data indicates that most juvenile cases are resolved through negotiated plea agreements, not adjudicatory hearings. It also shows, based on 2018-2019 data, the average case processing time in Circuit 9 for first-time juvenile offenders with felony offenses is 108 days. And the average case processing time for all juvenile offenders with felony offenses is 116 days. These periods are longer than the suspension of delinquency trials by the Florida Supreme Court, and they suggest the problem of getting youth tried within 21 days is not related to the current circumstances. It warmed my heart to be able to say that to her. But you know, I joke, but I don't joke. This is the kind of thing that I think the juvenile justice area in particular really lends itself to folks inviting a governor or inviting an agency head to overstep their bounds. The other thing that folks don't seem to understand from a separation of powers perspective is that with juveniles, not only does the governor not have any authority to simply release them, I obviously don't, but these children are under the jurisdiction of the courts. And we have to do, if a child is going to be released prior to his or her time to go, we have to go individually, child by child, to get the court's approval of that. But it is not for the Department of Juvenile Justice to do. That's why the youth have attorneys to do that. But nobody wants to do that. Everybody kind of wants to do the broad brush and get executive action to do what they want to do. And the other thing that I'm concerned about from that perspective is, and I'm seeing this a lot, is the bootstrapping of long-term juvenile justice policy onto an emergency situation called COVID-19 pandemic. I think that that is disingenuous of those who are advocating those kinds of changes, because now it is, well, you see, kids aren't in school, and they're, you know, the arrest rates are down. Well, they're artificially down. They were going down, don't get me wrong, but they're artificially down right now. This is not the data on which to build long-term policy. So those are kind of the issues that we have dealt with from a separation of powers and executive authority perspective.
All right. So we've been focused mainly on the state issues. Let's turn to the federal for a minute here. Chad, the administration in D.C. was largely deferential to the states, and the CDC guidance remained just that, guidance, allowing the states to actually issue the final edicts. You know, as federalists, we tend to think that's probably a good thing. You know, let the states control their own local dominions. But we've obviously seen some egregious uses of police powers. Do you think the federal strategy was the right one?
So I generally think that the federal approach was the right approach. You know, I think that the way to approach this, and I think the role of the federal government is really twofold here. Generally speaking, one, to give guidance to states. Number two, to do things that the states can't do. So what were some examples of that? Imposing international travel restrictions from China, from certain parts of Europe, from Italy at the time, from basically places where the outbreak was universal, was ubiquitous, and there was really no way to restrict that. At the state level, a lot of those restrictions came under federal authorities and had to happen at the federal level. But I think there's also a lot of other things that the federal government did, and they did right. One was trying to get PPE to states. You know, it sounds like an easy task, but a lot of that actually involved complex international negotiations with foreign governments. A lot of our PPE is actually manufactured in China, something that I think is a huge national security and vulnerability to the United States. So it involved many, many hours of phone calls between Homeland Security, FEMA, State Department, and government officials in China to try to get PPE out of the country. We were having conversations with senior executives at 3M, for example, other manufacturing facilities who were manufacturing products for the United States, but doing it overseas in China. So working with these people, I think in a way that only the federal government can, and only the federal government really has the resources to be able to effectively handle, including what we called Project Airbridge, where we flew tons and tons of PPE into the United States from China, able to get it here in an eighth of the time that it would have taken had we had to put it on a cargo ship and sail it across the Pacific. We got test kits. And I think, again, we tried to give a guidance to the states through the essential business list, I think was a good example. You know, we try to pride ourselves in doing a good job. You know, I think that the secretary probably has strong thoughts about whether CDC's guidance was clear or not. You know, luckily that was outside of my lane of jurisdiction. You know, the other thing I think we did unique to the federal government was we used the Defense Production Act in, I think, a really effective way. We were able to increase the amount of ventilators that were being made and produced into the United States and get those to states at critical times. We're also able to get this life-saving vaccine in record time using the Defense Production Act and using some of the authorities in that sort of Vietnam-era statute. What were some things that the federal government could have done better? I think we could have been more vigilant as states overreached and impacted individual liberties. We saw some good examples of this. DOJ sending a letter to San Francisco about the one congregant rule. If you guys aren't familiar with that, that was the rule that literally one human being was allowed in a church at a time. Doesn't matter the size of the church. Doesn't matter, you know, how many people can normally fit in there. Social distancing wasn't a thing. One person per church. I think San Francisco, after they got the letter from DOJ, saw the error of their ways and decided to rescind that rule. You know, DOJ also weighed in a case in New Mexico where New Mexico had posed a restriction and said that private schools can only operate at 25% capacity, but public schools, you know, private schools, of course, are likely the religious schools, public schools can operate at 50% capacity. Well, that restriction made no sense. Why is one school different than the other than the fact that it's private and likely affiliated with a religious organization or some sort of organization like that? So DOJ weighed in there. I do think DOJ could have done a better job in weighing in. Now, do I think that under the new administration, DOJ will continue to weigh in? No, frankly. I don't think that they care about religious liberty to the same extent. You know, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops came out and has already issued a public letter criticizing some actions that the Biden administration has taken as insufficiently protective of religious liberty. Other religious organizations have done the same. Some of the recent guidance we saw even to HHS, it doesn't make any mention whenever it talks about reproductive rights and things like that of religious objections to maybe providing some of those things. So do I think that the current administration is going to be as sufficiently protective of religious liberty as maybe the previous administration? I don't, and that's where I think really it's going to come to individuals who are going to have to step up and not be able to rely on the federal government.
So we've seen numerous challenges, both in state and federal court, to government orders related to COVID. Largely, they've all been kicked away pretty quickly. And courts have been very deferential to the government, you know, rational basis decision making. As we get further and further into this pandemic and closures and restrictions remain in effect, do any of you think the standard of review should have to change? I mean, if the numbers are staying the same out there, can we really keep churches or restaurants, livelihoods shut down indefinitely? This is for anybody.
You know, so I will jump in since I already have my mask off and say that it's not that the standard of review should change. It's that I hope that courts are skeptical now of the posture that some of these states are currently in. I hope that they see that it's not based on the data. It's not based on the science. I think the governor did a fantastic job yesterday of walking systematically through the data that we know, that the science that we have, through some of the studies that have come out, and shown that these intense lockdown regimes are not effective. And so I do think that courts, and I hope that courts are appropriately skeptical of claims that they are. And the other thing I'll say is that I hope that courts, particularly state courts, read their own state constitutions. You know, a lot of state constitutions are much more protective of individual rights and liberties, at least in the text, than the federal constitution. The California Constitution, for example, makes education a fundamental right. In fact, there's a case, Butt v. California, which says that the statewide public education system, per the terms of the Constitution, must be, quote, open on equal terms to all. It's laughable if California thinks that their public education system is now open on equal terms to all, particularly the poorest among us, particularly the people who can't afford laptops or iPads or internet or things like that. Our public education system in some of these states is not being open for all, and I do think it's incumbent upon individuals in that state to raise those sort of challenges, and I hope we see those.
Yeah, I'll just comment in addition to that. I mean, certainly I think courts need to take seriously, right, that we have individual rights and liberties that don't just go away because of COVID. I think also the same is true for kind of the structural powers, right, the separation of powers. So if you haven't seen an opinion by Judge Raj Singhal down the Southern District of Florida, it was a couple months ago. It's a really good opinion talking about a situation where Broward County tried to come in and shut down the sale of alcohol between midnight and 5 a.m. They wanted to shut down bars, right? But rather than using their authority to shut down a business and then potentially have to deal with the ramifications of why this business and not that business, right? They just said, we're going to restrict the sale of alcohol. Well, that's not their authority, right? That's a state authority. And Judge Singhal appropriately cites the governor's reopening order as having a preemptive effect on that. So I think as courts start thinking about not just the liberties, but also where the power lies and how it's appropriately checked, I think we can get some of this under control.
Representative, do you think all of these court orders out there that are, you know, siding with the government create a bad precedent for a potential future governor that may, you know, run amok with abuse of power? Have we laid a foundation where it makes it easier to do that?
Yeah, at my opening remarks about, you know, the three branches, the assumption is that when things go awry, that at least one of those three branches will step up and do the right thing. And this is the court's moment to step up and do the right thing, as Chad said so well. What you see here in this state, a governor who's trying to fight a pandemic, which is what we should be focused on. In some of these other states, you see governors who are advancing an ideological agenda and are saying and simply using COVID to go after gun rights, for example, because those are not their allies, or to go after religious freedom because those don't happen to be people that are their allies. In way one is essential or not essential. It may not be essential to them, but as, you know, last time I checked, it's very important in our constitutional liberties, the freedom of religion. And you see that happening. And so the courts, and I think it's a segue into the next panel, even on religious liberty, even this court, even a court that we thought would very clearly see the error, ruled the other way before the arrival of Justice Barrett. And so it's a good segue into the next panel about how important it is that Justice Amy Coney Barrett is on the Supreme Court. I don't think that can be overstated. But we do need to think about the future. And that's why, again, we have to stand up and do the right thing and make sure that we're explicitly clear so that when the courts look at our statute, that there's no wiggle room for a future governor that may use some pretense to do things that we didn't intend by these emergency procedures.
All right, I think we have time for a couple questions from the audience. If anybody has something they'd like to ask any or all of the panelists, we've got a microphone here and on either aisle, so please feel free to step up. All right, well, while people are thinking of potential questions, I'm gonna just go with the closeout question here. I certainly hope we don't have to have any more panels on COVID-19 here in Florida. I think we're all, you know, getting tired of it and are ready for something new. What are you most excited to move into in your either professional or personal pursuits that's not COVID-19?
You want me to start? We're a part-time legislature. I would love to have the time to pursue my day job occasionally, but COVID has certainly not made that any easier. But look, we'll get through it. I'm so proud of the governor and everybody, you know, in this panel that did such good work in balancing, and Joe, your office caring about individual liberties and really struggling, as you should, with a situation where it is uniquely an executive function to address this issue, and it has to be addressed aggressively to the limits of that power, but no further. And so we're just very fortunate. It's a reminder elections have consequences. I know I'm talking a little bit of politics here, but I'm just so grateful that we had you in that office and all of you and your respective offices and Governor DeSantis where he is. We are fortunate, but we have to guard against future infringements and look forward to working with you. And the Federal Society, really, this is your moment, too, to step up and talk about why the separation of powers, a seemingly dry subject, is so important.
One of the things I'm looking forward to doing once again is getting back out on the road. I haven't been able to do as much visiting of what I call my kids as I would have liked to because of the pandemic, and I'm looking forward to doing a lot more of that again. I'm looking forward to getting back to focusing on you know, long-term policy, midterm and long-term policy as it affects JJ. We're doing, you know, we've been so operation focused for basically a year for a particular reason, and it will be nice to be able to take a breath and really look longer term as we get back to normal. I am looking forward to the day when we don't have to wear these doggone things anymore. I want to be able to go and give my 66-year-old sister a big hug and a kiss, and not have to worry that she might, you know, contract the virus. But I just look forward to getting past all of this and getting, I won't say getting back to normal, but taking what we've learned and moving forward and pulling some of the things that we've had to do because of COVID and seeing if we can apply them long term. So for example, in my world, I was talking about the courts earlier. They have been doing video detention hearings because we've had to go to that. That's a fantastic thing to do in the long term. It saves money, it saves time, it doesn't infringe on any constitutional rights. It's efficient, it's effective, and it makes perfect sense. And I'm going to fight for that and hopefully convince my judicial friends to continue that practice.
Well, I'm kind of already enjoying what I hoped, which is I was commuting from Jacksonville to Tallahassee on a weekly basis, and now I get to actually come home every night and shoot hoops with my 13-year-old or go for a run with my daughter or wrestle with my younger son. So that's awesome to be able to do that every night. I was going to ask one question of the audience, because I think a lasting legacy that we have coming out of COVID that I'm kind of excited about deals with our authority to regulate the sale of alcohol. So raise your hand if you have taken advantage of alcohol to go. Look at that. All right. That's fantastic, right? So this was one of these little gems we hit on, and I think the governor's really excited about it. Not that he's a drinker, but he really enjoys seeing other people enjoy themselves. So hopefully that lasts.
The two things I'm most excited about, one being a fairly new Florida resident. The second, I'm really looking forward to suing the administration in states that overstep their bounds. But not Florida.
That's awesome.
I do think we have a question over here.
Hi, Jefferson Knight from Miami. My question, and also the question of a friend of ours who's now in Guatemala, Bob Allen. I was about to ask the question, and Bob texted me and said, ask the question, so it's for both of us. Are any of y'all willing to comment on what happened yesterday and the decision regarding the FBI agent Kleinsmith, who was given probation and no jail time after he admittedly forged a document that resulted in the FISA warrant being issued?
I don't know anything about that.
Anybody?
Nope.
I personally need to do a little bit more research before I could comment. All right, anything else for the good of the order? One more, all right.
It's Dan from Tallahassee. I had a question probably primarily for Representative Renner. You'd mentioned some aspects of the emergency management statutes with the authority to the governor that maybe could use a good hard look just to evaluate the scope of power that they have. I wonder if there's anything to be looked at in the division of power between the state government and the local governments in Florida as well, and the scope of any authority that local governments might have or might exercise in responding to emergencies that has similar aspects that could bear some examination.
Yes, and I did mention that earlier, and there is a separate statute on that, but I think we need to do a full comprehensive review of it. And again, where you've seen some really kind of bizarre requests, you know, similar to what Secretary experienced, where you have a local official that thinks it's a great idea to infringe constitutional liberties, you do see that more often where there's where that's happened, even in this state. And so We do need to look at that as well, and I think set a floor which cannot be broken that preserves individual liberties. Our Constitution doesn't go away in the midst of a crisis. And the challenge, and if you look historically, when history's taken a bad turn, it's been following a war, following economic devastation, and it could be a pandemic, probably one worse than this one, that could cause people in desperation to forego very, very important liberties and a demand that those be upheld even while we fight it. And so it's a tough balance, but we do need to revisit this. I think there's some areas for improvement that we could all agree on. And again, I'm just so happy we've got a great governor who's actually read the Federalist Papers and understands these issues very, very well and is on the same page as everybody here on the panel. And so that's a blessing.
In the governor's order, instituting phase three and reopening the state almost entirely, I believe it was Executive Order 244, he preempted locals from enforcing fines and penalties against individuals. He set a floor where you couldn't limit the amount of people in restaurants below a certain percentage. And he told the locals, if you're going to shut down restaurants, you've got to be able to do two things. You've got to be able to quantify what is the harm you are going to inflict on that business, and then justify why it's necessary to inflict that harm to further your local interest. I think something like that would be great to see codified in the statute. All right, I think this is the last question. I know our next panel is going to start a little early, so we'll give everybody a early release too. All right, go ahead.
Great. Alex Bowler, Tallahassee. You talked about the separation of powers between the federal government and the state governments and the local governments, and a separation of powers between the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. What about the separation between government and individuals? At what line, how do you decide when the individuals or the businesses should make their own decisions and when the government should make its decisions?
Anybody want to take the lead here?
I'll just reiterate that I think that's why this is the court's moment. The Constitution, as I think Scalia pointed out, is only as good as those that keep fidelity to it. And so, if you don't have courts that are going to step in and say, oh, no, you can't, then our Constitution is a dead letter. And so I think it really is, and Chad mentioned the importance, and grateful to see it, of small businesses and churches, people with not a lot of resources stepping up to defend their own liberties. And the courts have on many occasions affirmed those, and I hope that will continue. So I think it's a really great question.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. In addition to that side of it, I think from the business side, I mentioned, a certification body process for retailers. I mean, we need to think down the road, because, I mean, look, this could happen again, right? I mean, I don't think anyone would be shocked that there was a pandemic of a new virus, 10 or 15 years down the road, right? So we should be planning for it. And we need to plan for it in a way where we don't have to rely on government to use its power to come in and kind of solve everything. We want to have business already positioned to be able to adapt, right? Another example would be hospitals. I mean, hospitals in Florida have been tremendous partners in terms of getting PPE, ensuring that they've got processes that keep people safe, that get respiratory capacity. I mean, I'm confident the hospitals are going to be ready to go with this kind of thing if it happened again down the road. And so I think that's really a key, and we need to be thinking about ways that we can provide that flexibility almost for businesses to be able to care for their own employees and customers.
All right, let's thank our panelists.